Welcome back to Left Anchor. I'm Alexei the Greek.
And I'm Ryan Cooper. Today we're welcoming back to the podcast after a lapse of years, Mr. John Greenaway, who has written a book, a primer on utopian philosophy, it's called, An Introduction to the Work of Ernst Bloch. Bloch, of course, was a Marxist philosopher who lived, in Weimar Germany, in the United States, in East Germany, and in West Germany.
Man about town.
Yeah, some odd, a lot of differences between those places, even if they may have been geographically approximate.
And had a hard time fitting in anywhere because of his own idiosyncratic ideas and vibrant way of thinking about life and the need for revolution.
Yeah, but yeah, so Bloch wrote some real monster books. His magnum opus, what is it? The Philosophy of
Principle
Hope.
Of Hope.
Principle of Hope.
It's like three volumes.
1600 pages. luckily, this primer is only a few dozen pages. So don't.
If you're like Ryan, you're liable to take all three volumes with you on a flight to Greece and read it on the beach, which
That's right.
is something that he did with a comparable tome. And I kid you not, he was serious. He really wanted to do That's a good beach read for Ryan.
I did. Eventually, after doing that, travel is the only time I could work on that book. The Main Currents of Marxism was a book by Leszek Kolakowski. I did eventually finish the some bitch. Took it on my honeymoon. Not kidding.
Oh, baby. This is the kind of imagination Bloch would encourage.
Yeah. Before we get to the interview, we've got a note, that this podcast is sponsored by the American Prospect magazine. And so if you subscribe to our Patreon at $10 a month, you can get a digital subscription to the magazine as well as a discounted print subscription if you like. If you just subscribe at $5 a month, you'll get our bonus episodes, which are included in the $10 tier, of course. Otherwise, enjoy the free stuff. Send it around to your friends. Rate on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Without any further messing around, let's get to our interview with John Greenaway right now. All right. John Greenaway, welcome back to the podcast after many years. We're happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me back on. It has been years since I was last on the show, but
Horror Vanguard was just kicking off around that time, is that right? I think that's where we were.
Yeah, absolutely. We kind of just started Horror Vanguard, and that has now surpassed 300 episodes.
Fantastic. Congrats.
You may have heard our absolutely unjustifiable 9-hour episode on the complete on every single Halloween film. That I think just kind of put so podcasting changes you.
You gotta go big.
Yeah, I'm not the same person I was when you first had me on the show.
We'll have to, take the temperature, read how insane have we all gone over the past 4 years. So your book is called Primer on Utopian Philosophy, An Introduction to the Work of Ernst Bloch. But before we get to the book, can you, for people who maybe haven't been listening for, years consecutively, just introduce yourself to a little bit, who in the hell are you and what's your deal?
Who is this guy? Yes, my name is John. I am a para academic, ex-academic. I am writer and podcaster. So I am the author of books on horror, on the history of literature and culture. I have another book coming out this year called Capitalism, a Horror Story, which is builds on some of the stuff in this book in some interesting ways. So yeah, I try and write about political and cultural theory, about film and media, about politics from the left. And yeah, this book on utopian philosophy is, I think, probably one of the first English language introductions to the work of one of the most underappreciated and most interesting European philosophers of the 20th century. Still sadly untranslated for the most part. Lots of it is still in German. And so this book, it's very short. It's designed to be super approachable. It's designed to be of interest to people who maybe wouldn't consider themselves like philosophers or academics, and is out now with Zero Books as part of their really, I think, really important, really timely series of short, punchy little pamphlets and books designed to provoke conversation around this idea of philosophical utopia.
Well, it certainly is a punchy book. It's funny just because Bloch is famous for a lot of works, but The Principle of Hope is what, 1200 pages. And so not at all necessarily easy at all times to read. And you have what is, I think, a super accessible, but no less nuanced treatment, John. And I'm not just saying that because, I want to blow smoke up your ass. It's really, I really enjoyed reading it. And yeah. And so I'm curious, though, with Bloch, was it, Bloch himself or the idea of utopia? What drew you to this? You have a literary criticism background, and obviously that deals with philosophy a lot. But why in particular was this what you wanted to do?
So like we live in pretty dark times and pretty catastrophic times in some ways. And I think I remember I was reading the poetry of Bertolt Brecht, and there is. There's a great poem by Brecht where he says, what kind of days are these when to talk about, when a conversation about trees is a crime because it involves silence on so many other things. And it resonated incredibly strongly. And I sort of stumbled across Bloch as this sort of missing point in a lot of like Anglophone or English and American discussions of this period of history. So like quite a lot of people have heard of Theodore Adorno. Quite a lot of people have heard of like Marcuse or Walter Benjamin or Brecht. And Bloch is like the point that all of these people were writing both to and with and against through the 20s, 30s and 40s. You know, there's this tradition of thought which emerges out of the crucible of European fascism, right? These people lived in catastrophic times of perhaps even greater proportion than we do. I kind of stumbled into it. I remember finding The Principle of Hope, and it's 1600 pages across three volumes, written in very dense philosophical prose. And I remember tweeting it's somewhere in just before COVID, that out of a sense of like perverse stubbornness, I was going to try and read all of it. And at first I bounced off it pretty hard, but actually as I read it, and as I read the work of other philosophers who've spent a lot of time with Bloch, I realized that this is an incredibly kind of, Bloch is this incredibly charismatic thinker, and is sort of interested in everything. He's not a scholarly philosopher. Like he loves Goethe, and he loves like music, and he loves poetry, and he loves like dancing and food and architecture. And I just sort of fell into it and realized that there is this kind of great constellation of writing that is a resource. And there's a phrase that Bloch uses, that history is an archive and a weapon. And I was sort of like, oh, there's this kind of like huge body of work that is full of these kind of intellectual tools that we just don't have. If we're going to sort of like find a way out of despair, then like we need all of the intellectual resources that we can find. And I think this is quite timely. There's Tom Wyman's book, which came out a couple of years ago, called Infinitely Full of Hope. And I think for a time, if you're someone who's kind of politically engaged, it's been very easy to be like, things are bad and can only get worse. And there's a temptation to think of what we might call the bad new days. Again, which is a Brecht quote, but like, are we living through something new, or are we living through just the intensification of something that's always already existed? So this is why I think Bloch is useful and provocative. He says quite a lot that philosophy is directly connected with life, right? And if it retreats into scholasticism, then you've kind of stopped doing philosophy. Johann Sievers has a great line on this, where he says that we could say that critique has become uncritical. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of like word games that you play or this. So I was like, if I'm going to write about Block, I can't write it as a, even though maybe it should be a proper philosophical book full of footnotes and digressions and exposition. But this is designed to be a primer. And as I say in the book, a primer is something you pick up at the beginning of something. It's the start of something. You know, you prime a wall. If you're painting, you prime explosives. If you're trying to demolish a building, this is an intellectual primer. It's designed to be cheap and easy to read and is designed to kind of like start something for the people reading it.
Well, and it certainly does that. It certainly also gives a lot of questions that Block wrestles with and that he differs from other Marxists about. So much so that some, you know, castigate him as you say, as not really being a Marxist. He seems stuck in this no man's land between, you know, the Stalinists think he's not a real Marxist, and then he's too communist for some on the left.
Yeah,
right?
He was kind of caught between things. So a kind of very brief biography is maybe useful. So he grows up comes of like age in the 20s and 30s. He's very close friends with the Hungarian philosopher Georgi Lukács. Lukács is kind of most notable in English for History and Class Consciousness, which is a very famous book, rightly a very famous book. And the two of them basically taught each other philosophy. But Block comes from this tradition of what we might call kind of classical German thought. His big influence, the person that he quotes the most, is Goethe, right? It is speculative, it's supremely literary philosophy. And he ends up fleeing Germany during the Second World War. He ends up coming to Harvard. He speaks very little English, and he ends up writing The Principle of Hope in the Harvard Library over the course of about a dozen years. He ends up back in East Germany, ready to, you know, build socialism. But he's too interested in everything. He's very interested in religion for lots of very significant reasons. And this gets him into huge amounts of trouble. He is perhaps unforgivably slow to kind of talk about Stalin post 1956, but he ends up on the other side of the Berlin Wall. So for those in West Germany, he's this kind of like Stalinist throwback at best, or kind of like this naive sort of mystic figure. And then in East Germany, he's this dangerous revisionist. You know, he's accused of corrupting the youth, that's how you know you've got a cool philosopher. but he's trying to do something so like honestly jaw-droppingly audacious in his work, which is like this idea that hope is something more than just a subjective feeling, something more than just a moment where you might feel good. Hope is a philosophical, existential, universal principle that unfolds throughout the entirety of human history, culture, and political struggle. And to make a claim that big essentially means rebuilding philosophy from the ground up, which is what the Principle of Hope sets out to do and at the same time function as this kind of huge encyclopedia of all of the ways in which you can find in kind of human existence, in human culture, the persistence of this, of what he calls the utopian impulse.
Yeah, let's dig into this. So this is really cool because what you're suggesting is not just that hope is a practice instead of a feeling, as I might have mentioned before, but it's built into his ontology, which is, you know, we can explain what like process ontology means, right? Matter is a process, and temporality is part of the ontology, right? So can you speak a bit more about this idea that that hope is kind of embedded in temporality and in his ontology such that it is like part of the liberatory understanding of history's unfolding, right?
Yeah, I think the question is like, what do you think stuff is? And in many ways we go, well, stuff just kind of is. It's just this sort of like physical given that you encounter. But Block famously says like matter is not just some inert lump. He's very influenced by Aristotle. He says that matter has an end. There is a kind of unfolding process within it, which comes back to Block uses the term not yet in German, the nicht noch. So, you know, the seed is not yet a flower, and you wouldn't call the seed a flower, but the flower is present within the seed, albeit only implicitly. It's there. And this is not just an ontological principle for Bloch. This is a political principle. So I think this is why when we look at politics, it's very easy to just accept the kind of naturalization of the state of things. Like there is no way that, you know, you can't have any radical shift. You can't have any kind of breakthrough or change in politics because of the way things are. Yeah. And Bloch would say, well, no, things are never just the way they are. There's a great line that he uses where he says, as long as the universe is not this kind of like totally closed environment, as he puts it, there can be no objection to utopia made on purely factual grounds. And Bloch would say, well, so much for the facts. It's not that like he's this hyper volunteerist or like stuff can just like happen without reason. But he says that actually there are reasons and there's potential within the present that we are, for the most part, often completely unaware of. So the example, there's a couple of different examples that he gives. And so, you know, communism cannot happen tomorrow. It's not possible within but the conditions for a move beyond capitalism are latently present within the current situation. And how those unfold is not, I think a valid criticism of Bloch is he does fall into like teleologies a little bit.
Well, sure. I mean, like Aristotle is, but we can get into like different types of teleology because I think it's important. Just really briefly, like the idea that the acorn has within it the potential to become a tree, an oak tree, and that in fact is its purpose. It's fulfilling its purpose by becoming the oak tree. That potential can be frustrated, right? If the soil's wrong, if the conditions don't. So it doesn't mean it will become the oak tree. It doesn't mean it'll become the best version of the oak tree. But there are certain things that something is designed to become, and it might not live up to that, right? And so forth. Now, when you change from an acorn to a human being, you come into problems because we're not, as simple as that. But I think like Marxism both gets a bad rap, or there are bad versions of it that have like the turn and crank determinism that Bloch is against, which just says this is going to happen no matter what. This is how history is going to unfold and agency isn't really a thing. But also I see an allergy on the left and within Marxism to the idea of something like telos or teleology. And like, I think Bloch maybe like threads the needle in a nice way.
Yeah. So when he moves to West Germany, when he's quite old, actually, he's appointed professor of philosophy at the University of Tübingen, and he gives a lecture in 1961 to the public, and it's called "Can Hope Be Disappointed?" And there's a quote that I love from this, where he says, "Even a well-founded hope can be disappointed; otherwise, it would not be hope. In fact, hope never guarantees anything." It is characteristically daring and points openly to the possibilities that in part depend on chance for their fulfillment. Hope can be frustrated and thwarted, and out of the frustration and disappointment, it can learn to estimate the tendencies of processes that it had possibly estimated incorrectly. And I think anyone who's involved in sort of like leftist politics will recognize that we have had plenty of disappointed hope in the last 5 years, 10 years, whatever, like pick your poison. But it's like, does that call for like a kind of a rejection of hope as a philosophical idea? Bloch would say no, because all you've done is you've learned the first half of the process, which is a better understanding of the tendencies and the processes that are at work within the present.
So how does this, you know, as a sort of non-philosopher, can you get into the, you know, this distinction between the sort of orthodox, you know, vulgar Marxism and this more sort of nuanced view, you know, because like the orthodox Marxism, you know, say what else you say, whatever you might about it, like there is at least like a sort of a set of concrete mechanisms and predictions that are supposed to happen. It's like you have your crisis of profitability, and then, you know, the contradictions of capitalism like become insurmountable. Then you have revolution, and then, you know, it's socialism. It's just sort of stepwise, you know, just like what happened with the, you know, the end of feudalism and the rise of capitalism. Very, you know, analogous situation. So what, you know, if that's an incomplete picture, you know, what's us to say, how can we not just say, like, well, maybe this entire scheme, maybe there is no teleology whatsoever. Maybe capitalism could exist indefinitely, you know? Like,
Absolutely. What a nightmare. What an absolute, if that's all that we have as like a critique of capitalism, then God, like the odds are bleak. Block kind of highlights two, not really traditions, but sort of what we might call like styles of thinking in Marxism, what he calls the cold stream of Marxism and the warm stream of Marxism. And so the cold stream is exactly that. It's scientific materialism. It's contradictions in capitalism. It's the crisis of the overproduction. It's the tendency of the right profit to fall. And he says, like, on the other hand, you also have people are not motivated to buy into that completely. Depends upon thinking that people are motivated solely by very cold economic factors, that people are kind of perfect economic beings. And Block says, we've never really believed that that's true, right? That's an ideological presupposition. And he says, actually, if you go back longer, pre-Marx, there is this, what he calls the warm stream of Marxism, which is often tends to be quite prophetic, it's very stirring, it's rhetorical, it plays on the imagination, it plays on religion, and is this the call of justice, you know, it's the cry of justice in an unjust world. And those two things go together. So like, Marx famously was very critical of the utopian socialists of the 18th and 19th century, but he was also the first to admit that actually they have identified what the problem is. They just don't understand how to give us a coherent solution. And so Block says, if you only have the warm stream of Marxism, if you only have this like cry for justice, what you end up with is you end up with like revenge upon the world, what he calls Jacobinism. And he says, actually, if you only have the cold stream of Marxism, your Marxism gets lost in the mists of right revisionism, right? It's disconnected from the people and it's going to kind of splinter and fall apart completely.
And it doesn't understand the role of class struggle. Importantly, the utopian socialists, they just thought we, the enlightened ones, will instigate the change by just knowing that this is good and that'll do it. You know,
And people just need to, people will get it.
Just get on board.
And Block puts it quite well in The Principle of Hope. He says that the warm stream of Marxism, it needs lead pouring into its shoes to keep it on the ground. And the lead is the cold stream of Marxism that is engaged in the material political struggles day to day. That's what you need. But if that's all you have and you lose sight completely of even what that struggle is for, right? The Communist Manifesto itself is a really good example of this because a lot of it is written in what we might call the future tense of a speech act, right? It's talking about what the world could be or will be. Like, it's philosophy that is projecting itself forward, and by projecting itself forward is trying to create something. And so if you don't have that and all you have is this kind of like grinding day to day of like cold, hard facts, you end up just kind of getting lost in the kind of mists of things. And Block was very clear that you have to have both. You have to have this kind of like tension between these two things that you look very, almost very brutally at the current state of things, right? Without any false illusions. People think that hope means kind of like being a naive optimist, but I don't think those two things are the same at all. But Block was like, no, you actually have to understand just how bad things are. And to do that, you need, you know, the politics of class struggle. And in his day, you need a Leninist communist movement that is engaged at every level of society. But you also need to have an understanding of politics that encompasses both culture and the imagination. Because if you don't have that, tell you who does, fascism does. Fascism has a great politics that encompasses both the imagination and culture. Heritage of Our Time, which is, I think, maybe one of Block's best books, is basically like a sociology report of Weimar era Germany, where he breaks down every kind of strata of society, even down to things like dance competitions and local villages, and talks about how fascism speaks to a need that is not just economic, right? People didn't want just to be kind of richer. People didn't want the abstracted dream of a moneyless, classless, stateless society. Fascism promised something. And so Marxists at the time, they kind of fell into this trap, right? Lots of them were like, no, fascism is false ideology. And if you just tell people the facts, they'll get on board. That did not work. That did not work out. What you need is a kind of rhetorical, imaginative, cultural engagement with what is it? This is why Block writes all the time about what do people dream about? Right? What are your daydreams? Because he even thought like, even that is like politically revealing of like, what do you aspire to? So yeah, he's trying to unite both of these things. And I think we kind of accept on a day-to-day level in some ways that those things are necessary. They go together. But I think a lot of the time Marxists get quite a little bit like twitchy about talking about things like imagination and culture and dreams, because, you know, we feel kind of safer and securer on, you know, I can fight on the facts, but it's like facts alone are not enough, because it isn't that we are purely motivated by the idea of living post-capitalism is not an empirical statement that you logically agree with, right? Because your own investment and commitment to a set of politics often comes from non-rational places, right?
You need a conversion almost. I mean, right? If we're going to transform the world, we need kind of epiphanies, transfiguration, conversions. You know, we have something that's necessary in the subjectivity of people that is like complete transformation, in the same way that small bore policy change doesn't do it. Small bore changes in people's thinking and imagination won't do it either. Right.
I mean, the closest that American politics has seen in the mainstream is probably the last Bernie Sanders campaign, right? This is the very famous speech of like, what would you do for your neighbor? Right. The person standing next to you. That's not, there were plenty of like economic facts in there, but those are not economic statements, right? Those are not logical propositions to which you have to agree, but they are predicated upon this like imaginative vision of like what could be, but is not yet. And its failures and, you know, I think it's comparable that like the left has been kind of very hung up on Sanders in the US and Corbyn in the UK for quite a long time, and is maybe just starting to rethink those questions of how do you combine political strategy, that cold stream of Marxism, with a practical politics that reshapes.
So difficult to do. I mean, right, because I get a number of leftists think that they don't want to be seen as a naive liberal who both misunderstands the nature of the problem, doesn't have an ambitious answer, and is also pretty comfortable with the status quo. But on the other hand, a lot of leftists kind of enjoy almost being the melancholic like critic who is like, I remember when AOC got into office, there was a whole bunch of people immediately like, she's a sellout. She'll never do anything good. It's just structurally impossible, like all that stuff. And I was just, okay, you don't really want change. You just want to be able to call people out for not being, you know, pure enough in their politics. But like, if we can get into maybe that this kind of concrete utopia versus abstract utopia, and as you pointed out earlier, latency versus tendency, right? So there's this distinction between kind of a realism that says, well, this is what's currently happening, and so pragmatically, I'm not going to tell you it's possible for things that are outside of the current tendency to happen, something like that. But then latency also doesn't, as you say, think it's possible for us to have communism next week. So what does it look like to navigate that in terms of policy and politics? Like, for example, let's look at Gaza and the disaster, the genocide in Gaza. You might say that like being naive and thinking there could be this beautiful solution, you know, in the near term where there's harmony and peace is naive and goes against the reality on the ground. But then just giving in to like, well, it seems like genocide and ethnic cleansing is what's going to happen, so I guess we can't do anything. That also seems very bad. So how do we thread that needle, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is Bloch's answer. Bloch's answer would be put in the context of fascism again, right? You feel like you actually... So firstly, his thing was, right, you need a united front against fascism. Like the practical immediate problem is... How do you support anti-colonial struggle, right? That's the practical immediate problem. You want to be pragmatic? Fine. What is the utopian future? I mean, there's an incredible legacy and archive of Palestinian writing, particularly Palestinian poetry that's produced. Yeah. And there is the kind of like horrible idea of like, it's often held up as a sort of like cultural epitaph, a kind of eulogy, right? But that has a political function, because its point is to go, actually, it doesn't have to be the memorial over a mass grave. It can actually be a catalyst for a renewed sense of a reimagined sense of what this space and place and country and multiple peoples can be. So the political problem is enormous, incredibly complicated. And that's why Bloch's philosophical project is so complicated, yeah. Right? Because you're quite right. The distinction I draw at the beginning of the book is between hope and optimism. Optimism is the liberal response, right? Because the optimist looks at the world and kind of goes, well, the people running it probably know what they're doing, and things will generally tend for the best. And there might be some things which make me a bit sad occasionally.
John, just read Steven Pinker. We're marching towards
we have it's just going to happen. Future. Okay, it's just going to happen. You don't need to do anything. So this, and really, even optimists are in a way pessimists, because if you can look at the world and go, yeah, this is fine. You settle for so little. It's like you look at the world and you go, is really? This is all you want? you don't have anything within you that wants something a little bit more than just this? Whereas hope necessarily depends upon agency, right? You have to feel like in some way you can act to change the world that you exist within. Mm-hmm. And you can only do that if hope is more than just a kind of like subjective feeling. We've all had moments of hope, you know, watching mm-hmm. election results or watching, mm-hmm. but like, hope is the philosophy of, like, the world can still be less worse, right?
And yet it has to involve our subjectivity and our affective state, too. You mentioned poetry for a reason, probably, because mm-hmm. if I'm just the cold stream, I'm just thinking coolly analytically, I could kind of reason my way out of the urgency to come to anti-colonial Palestinian solidarity. But if I read that poetry, I'm moved emotionally in a way that might move me to act and that might make other people feel we have to do something now, right?
Yeah, the one thing that reactionaries and the right is very good at is understanding that politics is an imaginative act, right? It is something that is created and maintained. And so, like, again, this is why Bloch is so useful. We have this kind of, like, pervasive, this withering of the socialist imagination. Something that I was just introduced to that's a really good example is the mural at Bad Frankenhausen. So this is a place in Germany that was the site of the Peasants' Rebellion during the Reformation, where like a proto-communist uprising, essentially, against feudal lords. And so this town commissions an artist to create a mural to commemorate it. And it is this enormous 500-foot 3D immersive artwork, this great kind of like cultural statement. And again, for all of the problems of the USSR and Soviet communism, you had the futurists, the cosmists, you had socialist realism, you had a distinctive vision of what the socialist future, what the communist future was going to look like that was projected outward imaginatively. And I think post 2008, like imaginative projects are in very short supply, which is really strange to me because one of the books that I think this book has a lot of connection with is something like Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism. Like that,
that's an important concept to get into, by the way, at some point, if we can. Yeah.
Yeah. So like Fisher writes this book in what is it? 2008, 2010, Capitalist Realism Is There No Alternative, describing this concept of like naturalized capitalism. The kind of problem of like, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And Bloch in a way is a great resource for this. Of like, do you want to think beyond the present? Then you need the resources of someone like Bloch. The very end of Capitalist Realism, Fisher says that the end of history has to be taken as this huge opportunity, right? It used to be that this idea that like things could change radically pre-2008, sort of impossible. You had the long 90s, you had like the peak of Fukuyamaism. And Fisher says, we have to grasp this as an opportunity. And in fact, I think we underestimate the kind of scale of that statement sometimes, because there's this reputation that Fisher has of being kind of a miserabilist. but he is a pop modernist, right? Bloch too is a big defender of modernism, of like the artistic avant-garde, of expressionism in the early 20th century. Fisher is looking to like the pop culture of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where it's like, what was it concerned with? It was concerned with the future. And the end of Capitalist Realism says that like anything is possible, like which is an astonishing, like a genuinely like jaw-dropping statement, because so often it's taken to be like, oh, look, you can get your capitalist realism bedspread now. And we've reabsorbed this critique of capitalism into the mechanisms of cultural commodity production. It's like, I think people still underestimate the degree to which acknowledging what capitalist realism is, it's not the same thing as accepting the naturalization of that concept.
That's right. We did an episode on Children of Men, which, you know, Fisher talks about in chapter one. Remind me about this, if you will. We came to the conclusion there's actually a lot of hope to be found in the film, actually. And, you know, even though it's a very dark film in many ways and says a lot about, you know, capitalist realism, there was still a lot of hope to take away from it as well, right?
Yeah, I think you could maybe distinguish between hope, which is like, you know, kind of willful striving towards a better future, even in like conditions of utter horror, versus like Steven Pinker, you know, doing the dog, this is fine dog routine. You know,
these Panglossian liberals literally don't have anything to do.
Yeah.
Right. Because you don't need to do anything.
Justify the status quo is their big task.
Yeah. And that will happen pretty much with or without your involvement. So roll on. But you're totally right, Ryan. Like, hope is out of the conditions of like the worst horrors possible. And we have seen and lived and experienced so much of that. Like, there is, and it's often found in the kind of ruins of culture. That you actually go, no, people don't want this. Right? Like, this is not the world that people really want to live in.
Oh, yeah. That's another big thing that you know, the opening of what you write about Block is, or at the opening of Principle Hope, at least, is this idea that there's this lack or this gap or something's missing physically, maybe spiritually. Like, we all kind of feel this. But mm-hmm. in that feeling, that structure of feeling, there is hope. There is the potential to have not this, to have something better, right?
I was thinking about Vincent Bevan's new book, If We Burn.
Yeah.
Which is great and is about this kind of like basically the last decade of kind of, let's be blunt, kind of failed struggle, right? Let's be Coldstream for a second.
Yeah.
But like the thing that he says that I really like is like, if the last decade has kind of taught us anything, it's that there is this kind of generational desire globally for a quantitatively and qualitatively different mode of life. Right? Did it work? Have all of the problems been solved? No. Did any of these struggles kind of win in decisive and absolute and final ways? Probably not. No. But there is this kind of desire is not something that is extinguishable. And to me, that is a profoundly hopeful thought, right? It's like the ground of struggle. We have a tendency to be like, struggle is impossible. Even the struggle itself becomes impossible, right? This is what I say in the primer is that like our challenge is not to like think of what utopia would be like, but actually to think of like the struggle for utopia at all. You know, that's the conditions that we're in some ways are worse than the ones that Block was writing in, because the horizons of our political imagination have become so narrow. And the sense of what is possible kind of hollowed out by neoliberal discourse. Like,
well, this is important, right? Like the way that we look at the past and imagine the past and the stories we tell about the past is key, because it's all narrative and it's all, you know, myth making in a way, but the way that we do it smooths out the past as if it's a pure tendency trajectory, and we lose the fact that there's rupture all the time. And yeah. we don't appropriate or use as arsenal, right, the past as we should.
Yeah. I mean, Fred Jameson, who wrote Marxism and Form back in the 70s, probably gave one of the first English language introductions to Block. He says that like the job of a utopian historian is not to say like, this is what really happened in the past, but actually completely the opposite. And actually to like fundamentally destabilize what you think happened. And to underscore the extent to which ruptures and possibilities, and they were canceled, not because of some innate historical destiny, but through struggle, through and often like it because of political forces that kind of sought to narrow the frame in which struggle could happen. So like a really good contemporary example is this question in the UK of like free higher education, which is taken to be almost completely impossible, utopian, nonsense. It was the thing that existed. It was, yeah, it was a thing that was real and was taken away. And this idea that, like, well, there's nothing you can do about that. And it's like, actually, no, we had this. We had a system by which education was taken to be not something that was a bought commodity or a look or a luxury that you had to kind of take on debt to acquire, but was a kind of necessity for being a person, right? For actually getting to, like, be a subject in the world. So this, I think, is such an important point that, like, history is not this kind of smooth, you know, history does not run on railway tracks where point A was always going to lead to point B, which was always going to lead to point C. History is fought over. It's contested. And the job of a kind of utopian is to be like, actually, there are these potentials and possibilities within history itself, which are not exhausted yet. You know, oh, the mass movement, what was it? The revolution of 1911 in Russia failed. Oh, does that mean revolution was impossible? No, not at all. Look what happened just a few years later. And then you can trace those ruptures and possibilities all the way back, because Bloch, again, takes this huge macro view of history as these constant eruptions of struggle and striving towards a kind of liberatory future. It's why he thinks paying attention to religion is so important.
Right, yeah, but this is so interesting. He's the theologian of the Marxists in a way, right? Which is seems like a contradiction.
To quote Jameson, you know, if people go, oh well, Marxist, it's just religion, and like the inverse of that is also true. If you accept it, if you go Marxism, oh, it's just religion. Or it's go, well, you're religious. Yeah, it sounds like you're a communist, basically. he is the theologian of revolution, which is, and this doesn't require like believing in some, you know, transcendental non-material divinity, but actually understanding that religion speaks to these desires and dreams within people, and that the job of a kind of revolutionary movement is not to go, well, you should be atheists like us, but actually, as Bloch calls it, to kind of redeem the rational kernel within the irrational dream of religion. You know, one of my favorite books by him is called Atheism in Christianity, where he says that only an atheist can be a good Christian, and only a Christian can be a good atheist. This idea that actually, if you take the liberating tradition of Christianity seriously, you will basically reject this idea. That idea of the transcendental divinity will just kind of withers away. But if you, and that's how you end up at the fulfillment of, as he calls it, the God of Exodus, right? The God of this story of freedom. And it's been kind of encouraging to see a sort of renewed interest, particularly in the US, on like left engagements with religion. Because I think otherwise, what are we doing? This idea of being like, well, you should have do you know that God isn't real?
You know, John, as Marx wrote, the atheists of the world will unite, and that's what's going to lead to the revolution in the internet. It's just that small group of people that are atheists. They will take care of everything. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
And people even go like, oh, even people who don't take this idea of like, you know, you don't have to be an atheist. People go, you shouldn't have anything to do with religion anyway. And it's like, well, just on an empirical basis, that's an awful lot of people, right? An awful lot of people who have very strong ideas about, you know, helping the poor and clothing the needy and healing the sick. And they might be useful to have around.
This, you know, your discussion about like the foreclosing of the utopian imagination, it reminds me of something I meant to bring up that, you know, obviously I haven't read this massive book, but it seems like, you know, for reading your primer that Bloch is fairly, you know, scornful of like empirical, pragmatic, you know, policy wonk type shit, for lack of a better word. But it reminds me, you know, you're speaking about utopianism, like there's some value, it seems to me, in the notion of a utopian future that you could easily imagine or even point out in certain locations in the world. So I'll give you an example. Last year I went to Finland to write about their giant cooperative S group that accounts for half of the grocery market of the country. Massive enterprise, about the size of Trader Joe's in a country of like less than 5 million people. And that's like not a capitalist institution. It exists in sort of a marketplace that you could say is capital-ish, but it's like there's no, you know, capitalist owner. You know, it's owned by like 2.5 million Finns. Or you could point to Norway and say, like, look, the government owns most of the wealth in that country. You know, so there is, like, in a sense that the, you know, the government is, you know, run by representatives who are, you know, elected by the people. Like, there is to a pretty considerable extent, no, you know, the class, relation of class exploitation has sort of vanished in at least to some extent. You know, so like, is there a value, do you think, in Bloch's terms to being able to say, like, well, yeah, I mean, what if the workers own the means of production? Here's a policy program that seems.
I think to kind of give the Blochian response, he likes kind of like narrativizing things. So, you know, someone would turn around and go, oh, well, we couldn't do that here. We couldn't do that here. And so the obvious Blochian question is to go, why? Well, why not? And then immediately, you get into like often not economic reasons. You get into like, it's not American to do that. And you go, really?
Says who?
Bloch is not, like a policy wonk, right? That's not, and Marx himself is like very critical of like cooking up recipes for the cookshops of the future. But like, that doesn't mean it's not worth trying to do. And actually, these instances, and there are plenty of them, even within the United States, they're actually really useful as destabilizing the naturalization of capitalism. I think the resurgence of kind of militant unionism is a great example. These contestations of like, what does it mean to be American, or what does it mean? What's America? Like, all of these are like big, complex political questions, and actually philosophical questions that can be fought over. I think again, you have to have both, right? You have to have the kind of like forward looking, here's what could happen, and you actually have to have the willingness to look around and be like, actually, here's some ground from which we could start. I remember I was on another show talking about this, and you know, it's like, oh, we couldn't do really transformative educational work in our county. It's like, well, the police budget is right there. Like, those resources already exist, right?
Yeah.
That's the key. That's the key to kind of let people in on the kind of abortive imagination that they tend to have, or the failures of imagination they tend to have, and turn it on its head. I mean, one book I really like is The Problem with Work by Kathy Weeks, who appropriates Bloch, and she does it in a way that I think, Ryan, you'd appreciate because of you know, the utopian demanding bit, which says, look, some people think certain things are impossible, but if you just demand those things, suddenly they actually have to be talked about, and they're no longer impossible because now they're contested. So actually, universal basic income, we're demanding that now, right?
Yeah, or the abolition of work, the abolition of privatized healthcare. And, you know, I think of like James Connolly, the Irish revolutionary, wrote the very famous poem, "Our demands are modest, we only want the earth." Right? Demand everything. Because by doing so, you draw it into the field of discourse. You know, this is Mark Fisher's question to his young students. He's like, why aren't you angrier? A lot of stuff has been taken away from you by people and we know who did it. You should be going to these people and demanding it back. And that's just your starting point, right? I think bringing up Kathy Weeks is a really good point, and shows the ways in which this utopian thinking is not like abstract, right? It is like the principle of hope is so bound up with like often the minutiae of someone's life. Bloch wanted to call it dreams of a better life originally. And it's like, what do you dream about when you're at work, working the shitty job you hate? Do you ever drift off? Do you ever have a daydream about what the future could be like? And it's like, that's utopian. It's like, that's the ground from which you go, okay, what do you want? What do you want your world to be like?
This reminds me, John, I remember a few years back, AOC was at a rally in a red state. I don't know if it was Kansas or whatever. And she was talking about, you know, a world where, you know, the public goods of education, healthcare, all the standard like social democratic things were provided for in this country. And there was like a Fox interview with some woman that was in the crowd, some conservative woman. And she's like, it was confusing because at first I really really liked what she was saying. It all sounded so wonderful. And then I realized this is a trick. That can't be possible. Right. And like, that was the whole interview was about, like, it was supposed to be about how terrible AOC is, but the interviewee leads with, this is amazing. This is great. And they had to, of course, convince themselves that it's not possible. But if you engage and said, no, why not? Who's telling you this? What are you talking
about? We can do
tomorrow, actually.
Who told you that this is the world that you have to live in? Yeah. Don't go. Wouldn't it be great if we demand?
Yeah.
No, John, we can never. The red states are red forever. There's nothing we can do. That's the kind of thinking that impedes progress, right?
And this is why I think, you know, the great example of like liberal optimism, or not even optimism anymore. Like, liberals aren't optimistic. They just think they're better at managing. Yeah, they're just better at managing decline. Right. I think it's going to get better. No, but you don't want the other guy. What?
And so, you know what we need to do? We need to invite Trump to deal with the border crisis with Biden. So what we need to do, because this is, I mean, this is very practical stuff. If you don't see that possibility is real, then you end up doing this liberal bullshit, which is like trying to make, you know, liberals as reactionary as possible, as like the pragmatic move. A point that I think Block would make is that's not more grounded in facts or reality at all.
No.
Less so, probably.
Why? Because you're actually discounting all of the facts and reality that don't fit this schema, where political power is something that you can wield, where you can actually make like systemic interventions into the political field. This idea of like the liberal optimist, I don't, like, Pinker doesn't even believe it anymore, right? He's kind of swum off into reactionary territory. And it's like, without this twin synthesis of like an incredibly sober, unsparing, brutal look at the way things are, and also the kind of like philosophical audacity to demand better, It's really the only ground that you can have a kind of coherent left politics from, without either becoming completely divorced from the material realities of struggle, or just giving up on the idea of anything better in the first place.
It's funny, you know, all this talk reminds me pretty strongly of the Obama campaign in 2008, which is the first and last time I ever like actually worked on a campaign. I went and knocked doors in Southwest Colorado. I maybe convinced like 3 or 4 people to vote. It's probably the most effective political act I've ever done in my life. But you know, like, he had this book, Dreams from My Father, and that I read, and I thought was like pretty good when I read it. I mean, I was like, I don't know, 22 at the time. But his other book, The Audacity of Hope, and the, you know, Hope and Change, that was sort of like the whole movement. And we all bought it, all of us suckers, basically, who thought that this dude was gonna like fix the problems. And it strikes me as like a pretty good example of like why you, as you're saying, need both the things. Cause like, I don't know, people forget, like, there was such a, like, that night when he stomped John McCain into the dirt. He won Indiana, that Trump won by like 15 points in 2020. It was like the Republicans were just like reeling on the back foot. And there's this magical speech he gave the election night in Chicago. And like, you know, all the suckers were just deliriously happy. It was like, we did it. You know, we imagined a future. And like, you know, like that process of sort of giving in to the emotional, the rhetorical, the sort of like even mystical or quasi religious aspects of, you know, like, these are we want to like participate in something big. You want to make big change. Except it was completely devoid of anything except the same shit from the Bill Clinton years, you know? And so it was just like gravely disappointing. But I think you marry the two together and you had, you know, like, basically this was like the Franklin Roosevelt and why the New Deal, you know, just completely revolutionized America. You put the two things together. It's not the, you don't, you know, Biden's been so much better, at least in terms of domestic economic policy, than Obama, but he's, on the other hand, missing the inspirational leadership or, you know, sort of.
I'm going to push this a little further, because I think Block would say, like, if you have a utopian without, who's not a communist, you just get the recreation of this world, right? China Mayville has this great article where it's like, we already live in a utopia. It's just not ours. Right. It just doesn't belong to us. And in that article, Mabel uses the phrase, we have to learn how to hope with teeth, right?
And yeah.
Block is often kind of portrayed as this kind of like prophetic sort of mystic figure, this old man at protests. But like he was a committed communist and a revolutionary, and did not shy away from was the generational shift that happens in the context of the Russian Revolution. Because he was like, actually, what you need is not just like the one figure who can give the inspirational speeches. You need the mass movement, and you need a communist movement that is involved at every sort of level of people's lives and is able to help them kind of like understand why they have no time to socialize at work, and why they, you know, the kind of point of comparison is Vivian Gornick's book, The Romance of American Communism, which is this phenomenal set of oral histories of American communists from the first half of the 20th century. And the Communist Party was something that would raise you cradle to grave, right? At every single level of your life, the communist revolutionary movement was there. And people talk about it, not just as this thing that improved their economic conditions, which it did, but this thing which actually gave them a sense of kind of like a self that made sense to themselves. And it's like, it's a very beautiful book, and it's enormously sad because it comes to like stories of, you know, splits and schisms and things that happened in the 1956 generation. And it's hot. It's kind of heart wrenching for these people, because it isn't that they've been convinced of new facts. It's that this kind of like utopian impulse is kind of meets a failure point. So it's like, is utopia just the recreation of the world that is? No. Is utopia just like the election night when the things that I like happen to me and my friends? Kind of no. Block puts it in religious terms, and he says that Genesis lies at the end, not at the beginning. You know, Genesis is the last book, not the first book in the Bible. Because for something new to happen, for there to be this quantitative and qualitative break in how the world is organized, means that that the world as is ends. And this is why, you know, people might know that I'm the host of Horror Vanguard. I'm interested in horror films, and I've written about horror in literature and media quite a lot. And it's like, horror is the kind of like condition of the present. And it's like, horrors can end though. So it's like, I feel like it's maybe quite an audacious claim that if you like want to be a utopian, you have to kind of be someone who's looking for the end of capitalism actively. This is why Jodie Dean says that she likes to call herself a communist, because to call yourself a communist names the contradiction, right? It kind of like says what the opposite of the current system is. Maybe one of the great utopians of European philosophy of the 20th century is a guy called Darko Suvin, who's mostly known for writing about science fiction. And he says that like the choice, the utopian choice, is you either have the continuation and continuing like falling apart of capitalism, or you have a kind of struggle towards what he calls communism one, which is a communism of democracy, humanism. These things, you know, this is someone who's raised in Stalinism. So it's very like anti-Stalinist. So I think sometimes it's very easy to be like, well, if we win this election, that will be utopian. And like the kind of audacious challenge of a lot of Block is like, is that it? Is that all you want? And this is maybe kind of like quite a strong, I don't want to come off too strong, but it's like these moments that we see. And I remember watching Obama's speech at the park, mentioning Joe Biden. And it's like, you know, I was a student at the time, and there were students, American exchange students, like turning up in tears, and like incredibly powerful moment. But it's like the kind of message of Block's philosophy is that is just a moment, and that isn't enough.
No.
And we know that. Right? So I want to ask a few questions about that. So for example, when, Obamacare got passed and Joe Biden said this is a big fucking deal in Obama's ear because he was clueless about the open mic or hot mic or whatever. Anyway, in that moment, and of course, in retrospect, we understand fully how meager that was. Sure, it did some good things, but also it was kind of disastrous in how much it promised and how little it actually did for Americans. And boy, we could even compare that to current healthcare around the world that's much, much better and so forth, obviously. But in a moment like that, where relative to what has been, that feels to some like a victory. Are people supposed to feel hopeful because of that? Are they supposed to feel that is bullshit? That's not good enough. Like, I feel I'm actually mad because that's so paltry. We deserve more. Like, the affective part, like, how are we supposed to feel when something like that happens?
Is hope just the feeling? I guess is the response.
But it does involve feeling, though. It does involve feeling.
Yeah. And it's like, in many ways, like, those feelings are sort of almost kind of instinctual, right? They come out of us almost, seems like, spontaneously. And like, the point is, what can you build on that, right? It's not to discount them, right? I think we've had, I think everybody who listens to this is going to have moments of like, you're on a picket line, you're at a protest, you're at like, you're at a gig, you're like with the people that you love. Like Peter Thompson, the kind of great British Bloch scholar, has this great quote about Bloch's work, which is like, utopia is often unbearably close. Right. Yeah. There's like, you have these moments. I think picket lines and strikes are a great example where you go, look at what you can do. Right. But if that's all we have, and if that's not the starting point of like, how do we build? Then we come into problems, because those feelings are good, natural, and like important, because they bring people to kind of self-consciousness. Right. Where you actually feel like you have agency. That's the important thing about those moments of like winning an election.
You have to feel like what you do matters. You have to feel that. And those like strikes and protests, those things have that effective boost where you literally feel, okay, some things can change. And yet you're saying also there needs to be this understanding that there has to be like an insatiability, the struggle will always continue kind of thing. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, this is why you need both the cold and the warm stream. Cause like, if all we do is we let ourselves kind of be caught in the moment, like that moment's end, right? They dissipate. Election night ended and then the American empire kind of continued to turn in so many ways. And were there things that made life better materially for people? Yes, those are big achievements, but those moments are quickly kind of absorbed and restabilized by capitalist systems. So I think this is why you have to have both. You have to have those moments of going, actually, look what you can do. Look what you can achieve. Look how meaningful in the world your actions can be. And then you have to have, like, almost at the same time, like simultaneously, you have to have these concerns of like, okay, what's next? How do we formulate our strategy so that like, these are not just fleeting moments, but this is the condition of life, where you kind of wake up and everything you do has that feeling of meaningful difference to the world that you live in. And it's like, that is immensely complicated. But again, this is why Bloch is such a complicated philosopher.
If you have time, I have one more question and you can decide whether we have time for it or not. But just because you gave such a great response about Obama, and you talked about the need for a truly communist, or we might say anti-capitalist, transformative, I don't know if it's the vision that we need, but if in getting there, right, this is the issue that relates a little bit to what we talked about. Like, we can't just say everybody has to be an atheist, or we could just go after atheists to involve them in the popular front. There are so many internecine battles on the left, so many like, what is socialism versus social democracy? What is communism? What is, the right tries to say that Obama is a communist. Like, so how do we approach, like you say, this need to realize the truly anti-capitalist / communist vision that's required, or change that's required, that hope should involve, when you have people that you want to get active and motivated politically who are struggling with, wait a minute, I heard that socialism just means the government does stuff, or, you have these sharp divisions over these conceptual understandings, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's an easy one to solve.
Sorry, I didn't want. I just, I thought.
Okay, so a couple of thoughts more than anything, rather than like coherent responses. I don't think it is a shock that in the previous decade there were lots of experiments in horizontal organizing, and kind of like, and all of those I think are valuable, even if you can go, well, they failed or they didn't work. And I think now there is going to be a return to questions of political strategy. And to put it more bluntly, like a return to like how do we rethink the lessons of Leninism or of like of other like mass political movements
as opposed to anarchist horizontalism.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think it's putting one over the other. Place. It's like how do we kind of like redevelop questions of like mass political organized political strategy? And I think that's an incredibly important thing. To your point about like all of these internecine battles and all these people who have kind of these preconceived notions of like socialism is when the government does X and the more X the government does, the more socialist it is. They're coming to take my toothbrush. It's like there's a letter that Marx writes to Arnold Ruge in 1843. The Bloc is very fond of quoting. And Marx, the letter says that our program must be the reform of consciousness, not through dogmas, but by analyzing mystical consciousness obscure to itself, whether it appear in religious or political form. It will then become plain that the world has long since dreamed of something of which it needs only to become conscious for it to possess in reality. Our task is not to draw a sharp mental line between past and future, but to complete the thought of the past. Lastly, it'll become plain that mankind will not begin any new work, but will consciously bring about the completion of its old work. So the question is like, the way to overcome those things is not through facts, right? It's not to like, but it's to like, do we recognize that history in all of its kind of like diverse localities is essentially about class struggle? And if we do, how do we connect the class struggles of the present to the history that these people are already involved within in some ways? And again, this is why Bloch is such an interesting, untimely thinker, right? I often think of him as kind of like a Janus figure, right? He's looking backwards all the time, but at the same time, he's looking forward. And I think this is a really good model to put into our own thoughts of like, what do we learn and what do we see in the past? And how do we actually pick up what was given to us? You know, Walter Benjamin, who was Bloch's like close friend, talks about like, oh, the dead won't even be safe if we lose, right? Brecht talks about the fascists are planning for 10,000 years. You know, that's what they want. And you know, it's apocalyptic. Those are the stakes. I quote in the book Rosa Luxemburg's famous saying in the Janus pamphlet, socialism, we stand at the crossroads, socialism or barbarism. And in many ways, it seems like the choice has been made, right? It seems like the crossroads is back there. but even if that's true, and this is something the philosopher Kat Moyer points out, even if that's true, the stakes of that choice become even higher. Right. Even if in some ways the choices have been made, it means that the choices that are made now are actually even more important. Because the choices imply that one, agency is still possible. And two, even if the destination is not going to be the idealized perfect vision, it will be different from what is. The final thing I'll say is that Bloch liked this phrase that the people will be made by the process will be made by the people who are made by the process. Right. What is it going to look like? It's a process. And who is it made by? It's made by those people who are shaped by the process that is being made. And as I put it in the book, utopia is not a program. It isn't a party. It isn't a place, but it is this unfolding trans-historical cross-cultural struggle towards something better. And what that better is not something that's predetermined, right? It's something that has to be fought over and argued over and engaged with. Because if we don't, the stakes are too high. Like the alternative is far worse. I recognize that's a wildly insufficient answer to what you asked me.
That's great.
A big question.
It's an unfolding. It's a great start. We three podcasters are doing it in this episode right here. You're doing it with your book.
Great. Well, John Greenaway, the book is called A Primer on Utopian Philosophy, An Introduction to the Work of Ernst Bloch. We will slap a link to that in the show notes. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so, so much. It was a real pleasure.
And thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you in the next episode.